This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. As we enter spring, an average of 2 million people in the United States are being vaccinated each day. It finally feels like there's an end in sight to the pandemic. But we're not out of the woods just yet. More than a dozen states have seen increases in their daily case averages. In Michigan alone, there's been a 92% increase in COVID-19 cases in the past 2 weeks. And in Europe, several countries have had to lock down again after a surge in cases. While many state governors are reopening businesses at breakneck speed to help struggling economies, experts say it's too early to forge ahead with increasing capacity for indoor dining, gyms, and other places where the virus can spread easily. And new variants and increases in travel are also to blame for some of the concern among experts about a potential new wave of the virus. Here's Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC.
This just at a time when we have still 50,000 cases a day, and we know our variants have traveled through these airports. We know that travel is a time when people bring these variants home, bring these variants to other places. So we're balancing the fact that vaccinated people will likely travel with unvaccinated people. There is travel happening. We had surges after July 4th. We had surges after Labor Day. We had surges after the Christmas holiday, and we want to just make sure we're doing it safely. We're actively reviewing it right now.
Emily Martin is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Emily, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, Tanzina. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Michigan, where you are. We saw a 92% increase in COVID-19 cases in the past 2 weeks. Emily, what is driving that?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing an increase here around the state. The starkest increase appears to be in youth, in people aged 10 to 19. We're seeing a lot of increase in that age group. And that's where our sharpest rises are happening, but we're also seeing rises in younger adults, 20 to 29, 30-year-olds as well, starting to follow with that as well too. You know, we're seeing a lot of outbreaks in, not in school activities, but what I call school adjacent activities. So sports, gatherings, the types of things that kids participate in when they're sort of out and moving about.
What kinds of policies has Michigan put into place? Well, before I even ask you that, I mean, this is a sort of a surprise, I would say, in terms of who is driving this. We've been hearing a lot about how children in particular might not be as likely to contract COVID-19 or as likely to pass it on. Is this surprising to you as an epidemiologist?
Well, I think we've been sure for a while that children don't get as sick as often. They can get really sick, but it's less common. But the data is actually pretty strong that children can spread, you know, certainly to each other and possibly to the adults in their lives. And we've seen this in other states that have had, I think, more active in-person school than we've had here in Michigan. I think recently in Michigan, we've seen a change towards more in-person school happening over the last couple of weeks and months, which is certainly really important for development and to support parents. But I think it's sort of natural in my mind that we start to see more transmission around this group who largely many of these kids have been home for the last year.
We heard also the director of the CDC at the very top before we brought you on, Rochelle Walensky, here, say that some of this is also potentially happening as we increase travel. Are you seeing that happening in Michigan? Does increase travel? We know that more Americans are traveling every week as more people begin to get vaccinated. Is that a concern as well?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing increased movement both inside the state and then out, you know, more kind of vacation traveling happening as well. You know, one of the things we do here at U of M is we take a look at and monitor different sources of how often people are moving around the state using various sources of cell phone data and whatnot. And we're seeing that the movement looks a lot like it did even before the pandemic, like last year's spring break, in terms of how much people are moving around.
We know that surges in the virus, or should we say waves of the virus, or when the virus peaks, tend to happen after, as the director of the CDC mentioned earlier, tend to happen after large gatherings. So holiday weekends, we've seen them happen after Christmas and Thanksgiving and last summer. Are we expecting to see that same thing as we're now in spring break?
Yeah, I think we're watching for that, connected to kind of spring travel, especially in the young adult age group. watching to see anything that might happen from spring break travel. But, you know, even aside from the travel, it's recently gotten really nice here in Michigan. And that's almost a holiday in and of itself. People are out and about and they want to gather and they want to get out there in the nice weather. And so I think that's really going to seed a lot of gatherings. And then we run the risk of having to get more transmission tamped down after that.
But Emily, aren't we okay if we're gathering outside? Or is it that people are gathering and they're sort of forgetting their masks? And I say forgetting in air quotes.
Right. Well, and if there's a fatigue, you know, all the way through with keeping your mask on when you're gathering, you know, and it's one thing to gather outside, but then do you all move inside once we get to kind of the cold spring Michigan evening, right? And so we still have to take those distancing masking precautions to keep these, to keep the numbers down.
We here in New York are hearing a lot of news about a new variant that has made its way here to the city. There's lots of news about variants, international variants that have come to the United States. What is the state of, is the current spread in Michigan from the original COVID-19 virus, or have there been variants that have taken hold in the state?
Well, the reality is we have both. So we're seeing rises in what the original strains that we saw before. We also have a transmission of B117, which is the variant that was identified in the UK. We have that in Michigan. You know, a lot of the B117s that have been reported have been from these sort of defined situations. We've had a lot of cases identified in correctional facilities, unfortunately. We've had some clusters in educational settings. But you know, we don't seem to, you know, I guess the jury is still out in terms of how much variant is spreading throughout the general population. And, but, you know, we know it's definitely here. It's probably on the increase. And so we're fighting both right now.
We're talking about COVID-19 and how we're not quite out of the woods yet here in the United States. This is The Takeaway. Emily, Michigan is one of the worst states in terms of increases. Has the state done anything in terms of changing its policy that may also have led to this spike in cases?
Well, yeah, this is a really interesting thing that we're seeing because we're one of the worst states in terms of increases right now, but we started out from a point that was a little bit below our peers in terms of our neighboring states. And I think, you know, we've recently had an adjustment so that our policies are closer to the neighboring states. And that's for things like youth sports. Indoor dining has increased in capacity. We've had loosening of gathering restrictions and sort of more allowances for doing sort of large outdoor events in the state. And so we've definitely had a lot of movement towards re-engaging in Michigan. And it puts us more in line with what our neighboring states have in terms of policies, I think.
There have also been, I'm wondering whether the state's efforts to reopen, we know that governors are under a tremendous amount of pressure from businesses. We're seeing that here in New York. We see it in states across the country to sort of reopen. And some of them are moving faster than experts say they should be moving. There was recently efforts here in New York to increase indoor dining capacity to almost 75%. That effort has now been put on hold, as our mayor has said, you know, we're going to stay at 50 because we want to be cautious. Are Michigan lawmakers being cautious enough, in your medical opinion, about where we stand right now? Should things pause in terms of reopening efforts before they get worse?
You know, I think they're in a really challenging situation, you know, because we know that economic stress is also a public health challenge that we need to pay attention to. And so balancing both is a really, it's a really tough thing to solve. I do like Michigan's recent focus on getting kids in the classroom as safely as possible, because that's one of the places where we see standing down on that for a while is going to have public health impacts, developmental impacts. And so I think that that's been appropriate. Right now, the mitigation strategies that we really have available to us, these are the ones that are really hard to enforce, like distance when you're gathering, you know, gathering safely, wearing masks. One thing we have done in Michigan that I like is that the masking is still universal all over. And I think it is really important to keep that in place like we have right now to sort of tamp in some of these other openings that are happening.
as an epidemiologist, as you see these variants across the country, and at the same time, you see an average of 2 million Americans getting vaccinated, at least the first dose of the vaccine, in some cases, all the second dose of the vaccine happening. There feels like there's a tension between, and we've heard this a lot, between the virus and the vaccines and, you know, and the variants and who's going to win. Are we still in that race right now? Or, I mean, it's a little too early for us to let down our guard, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like this analogy of being in a race with the variant. It's like you're in a, it's like you're in a race with the virus, but then suddenly the virus starts to run 50% faster. And so what we need to do is we need to get ahead of this thing before that really happens, before the virus really speeds up its transmissibility. We have a much, much easier job of getting this under control, the vaccine, if we do it now versus if we do it after we're contending with the variant.
And I'm wondering, you know, children, going back to children, I mean, the children are going to probably be some of the last groups to be vaccinated at the pace that we're going. What do you think about that? I mean, should given what we're seeing in Michigan, should children be prioritized for the vaccine if this is what we're seeing in terms of spread, or is it still too early? I know that some vaccine manufacturers are still testing the effects of the vaccine on children. Is it still too early? Where do we stand there, Emily?
Yeah, it's, you know, the unfortunately, the vaccine's simply not available for children yet, especially children in the age group that we're really watching right now. And so what we need to do is focus on these other strategies we've been using, masks, distancing, thinking about how we can have our children do some of these activities, but in a safer way, using testing, using masking as much as possible in order to get them through until the vaccine's ready for them.
And as we've got less than a minute left, but should people hold off on travel, on recreational travel? I know that's a hard ask given that the summer is coming and spring is here, but what's your professional opinion on that?
I think still being conservative is a good idea. You know, for spring break, my family, we're doing something just with the three of us, very limited. And I think you can still think about how to do some of the activities that you like safely and minimizing your engagement with the general public. And I think it's still time to be a little bit conservative.
Emily Martin is an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
As the summer beckons and vaccines are getting into arms, many people are dreaming of traveling right now. But with the coronavirus pandemic still raging, we may all soon need a different kind of passport to travel anywhere. I'm talking about a vaccine passport or documentation showing you've been vaccinated against COVID-19. In a number of countries, including China and those in the EU, recently announced their plans to implement vaccine passport programs. And in Israel, where half the population is now vaccinated, residents have started using vaccine passports called the Green Pass to do everything from use the gym to eat out at restaurants. And while supporters of the vaccine passport say they'll help us return to some sense of normalcy, some other experts say they may do more harm than good. Nikita Farahani is the Robinson O. Everett Professor of Law and Philosophy at Duke University, and she joins me now. Nita, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What's the primary purpose behind these vaccine passport programs?
I think everybody's looking for a way to be able to safely reopen and try to identify the people who pose the lowest risk to other people. And vaccine passports seem like a promising way for some people to make that happen.
You said they seem like a promising way.
Yes, I have my doubts about it.
Do tell. What are the doubts? It sounds like, right, I've got my card, I've got my passport, I can go. And you have some doubts.
So,
tell
us
what those are.
Well, I mean, so first is just, will they be effective? And, you know, there's some encouraging data about some of the vaccines that suggest that people who have been vaccinated are unlikely to become infected themselves and spread it to other people. But we don't have that conclusive proof yet. What we have is information that shows that if you have been vaccinated, the risk to you of getting severe disease goes dramatically down and the risk of getting sick goes dramatically down. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't pose a risk to other people. And so there's this potential false sense of security and false sense of hope that people may have in relying on vaccine passports as the way to reopen. I think it might result in people letting down their guard more than they should, choosing not to do things like social distancing and masking and other kinds of procedures that we've put into place to try to increase safety. So from a safety perspective, I have my doubts, but from an ethical perspective, I have much more serious doubts.
Well, I think that's really where, I think from safety obviously is important, but the ethical concerns here, you know, I've heard people say things like, well, is it fair to have, you know, gatherings or to leave people out or to say, you know, vaccine only, you know, are allowed, for example. Is that what you mean when you say ethical concerns?
It is. So, you know, I think let me start by saying I could imagine a future in which vaccines are widely available to everyone. They have gained full regulatory approval. And we say, under certain conditions, you have to be vaccinated in order to participate in different activities in society. We do that already, right? We have vaccination requirements for schools. We have healthcare workers who have to be vaccinated. So I can imagine some future scenario in which it would be ethical to have a coronavirus vaccine requirement in certain settings. Right now, that's not what we have. We don't have vaccines with full regulatory approval, and we certainly don't have widespread equal access to the vaccines. And so if you start to say, we're going to condition your participation in society on whether or not you have been vaccinated, when it isn't even a choice for many people to be able to get the vaccine, what you have is, you know, a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, the people who can get early access and the people who can't. And we haven't even prioritized vaccination based on who has been most severely impacted economically by the pandemic. Instead, we've looked, because of the moments of time that we're in, who's at the greatest health risk. Those are the people who are getting the vaccine first, or the people who have figured out how to get the vaccine first, which is generally not the people who've been most disadvantaged by the pandemic to begin with.
There's been an ongoing discussion about those folks on my Facebook page. We're talking about vaccine passports and what it means for us in the near future. It's The Takeaway. The issue here, I wonder if, you know, as you said, not everybody has access to the vaccine. What about questions of privacy? I mean, a lot of these passports might be pieces of paper. A lot of us are getting cards when you get your dose and, you know, the card you can put away. But will some of this be appified, if you will? I mean, will some of this be, you know, information that will be available to people that, you know, can sort of track whether or not we are vaccinated? And does that cross any ethical or health care lines?
Yeah, there are so many ethical and serious concerns for us to consider. We haven't even talked about the differential impact on minorities, but let's focus on this privacy and surveillance issue. So, you know, a lot of times when you have a major crisis, like take 9/11, suddenly there's a rollout of a lot of different procedures and provisions to try to get us to a place where we can safely engage in some of the activities we want to engage in, like travel. The result in the short term is that people are encouraged because it opens up their ability to do the thing that they're scared to do, get on an airplane, know that it's safe, go into a grocery store, go into a restaurant. But the problem is, once you put those procedures in place, they're almost never rolled back. And so with vaccine passports, you see a number of companies, whether it's IBM or Microsoft, you know, earlier on Google and Apple talking about partnerships to do so, different governments who are rolling out these types of passports, who are going to collect your health information. Some of these are entities who haven't traditionally had access to your health information, and they already have a lot of other information about you. What are the safeguards to prevent the commingling of that information? And will there ever be a rollback, right? Once you give that healthcare information to these companies, do you ever get it back? Now, some people might say, okay, but I don't care if people know about my vaccination status. What I worry about is opening up the gateway for these companies who don't have traditional privacy practices for healthcare information. They're not covered entities under our traditional healthcare privacy settings. For those companies to suddenly have access to a lot of this information, it opens the gateway for collecting all kinds of biometric information without any privacy or surveillance safeguards in place.
We talked about the inequities when it comes to privacy, but what about the inequities when it comes to communities of color?
Yeah, this is an area that I'm particularly concerned about. So, you know, first, we've seen in this country that the minority populations have been hit the hardest by the pandemic. And that's true economically as well as in terms of health consequences. And that's, you know, due to traditional inequities in access to healthcare and access to adequate healthcare, but it also, you know, suggests a difference in their ability to do things like work remotely, stay home. They've been in the firing line of the greatest risk. So now these individuals who could have been prioritized for access to vaccines, and certainly the World Health Organization and the CDC made that recommendation, states haven't done so. And so they're not getting early access to the vaccines, which means that the people who've been the hardest hit by the pandemic are not the ones who are already vaccinated or likely to get vaccinated soon. The result is, if they're the ones who are excluded from being able to go to restaurants, from getting jobs, from being able to participate in the society, you see this widening gap. Some people think, and kind of the early theories were, it was due to significant public mistrust, that there was a hesitancy to get the vaccination. But
I actually think that narrative was a little overdone, frankly.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And in fact, what we're seeing is, it's more likely access to technology, the kind of, you know, who you know and how you can get the vaccine appointments. A lot of people are figuring out through tech, through who they know, through gaming the system, how they can get early access. And that's not true in the population that's been the hardest hit. So I worry that this just means you're going to see an increase in inequities, an increase in the widening gap, which means, you know, putting into place a vaccine passport as a way to gain access to goods and services and jobs means that we're just going to continue to exacerbate the kinds of inequities that the pandemic already introduced.
And we're also not requiring people to get vaccinated. So there are people who could say they don't want to get vaccinated and then really just sort of, you know, be left out entirely, right?
That's true. And, you know, I think for those individuals who can't get vaccinated for health reasons or who have legitimate concerns about the fact that they don't have full regulatory approval yet, it doesn't make sense to say those people can't participate in society. Now, maybe when we get to the point where everybody has access to the vaccine, it's widely available and we have great data that is longer term data about the safety, maybe then we would feel comfortable in certain settings saying everybody needs to be vaccinated for the safety of others.
Is there a way to do this equitably? We've got a minute left.
Well, you know, I'd say at the point at which we can do it equitably, we probably don't need vaccine passports. That is, once we actually have widespread availability of the vaccine such that anybody who wants one can get one, the likelihood of having an unchecked pandemic like this goes way down. And so then, you know, whether or not you have vaccine passports almost becomes irrelevant, because the risk to people of going to a restaurant or going to their jobs or, you know, going to school or participating in everyday normal activities really won't continue to persist, at least we hope. And so, you know, there is a point at which you can do it equitably. I just don't think it'll be necessary when that happens. So, you know, I think the right answer is, we need to focus on making the vaccine widely available to everybody, and we need to figure out a way to enable people to participate in society without conditioning it on their vaccination status.
Nita Farahany is the Robinson O. Everett Professor of Law and Philosophy at Duke University. Nita, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Tess in Newport, Rhode Island, and I don't agree with the idea of a vaccination passport. It's looking increasingly likely that we're going to be needing boosters, repeat vaccinations, similar to what we do with the flu shot. So I don't see how that process can be accomplished in any simple way that's not really onerous to the travelers. So no, I would not be in favor of that.
My name's Joseph. I live between Massachusetts and the south of France. I just flew to Nice today, left the United States with my COVID test. Got to Nice, checked in, no problem. When I come back to Boston, I just walk off the plane, walk into the luggage area and leave. It's business as usual. So for a COVID vaccine passport, no thank you. I don't want to take the chances. I'd rather get a COVID swab test, which are available all over Europe for free. It's harder to get a test in Worcester, Massachusetts, where there's 800,000 residents and two COVID centers. South of France and Cannes, 75,000 people, 15 COVID centers.
My name is Sherry. I live outside of St. Louis, Missouri. I would like a COVID passport for my own safety, but I don't know that it's fair for minorities and those with lower income, because they just don't have access to vaccines as much as I do.
Yes, absolutely. I agree that we should be asking for proof of vaccination for people to be able to travel or go to events this summer in the United States. We should see more outdoor events this summer, and even with reduced seating capacity. But I want to know that those around me are safe to be around. I respect that refusing the vaccine is a personal choice, and with all choices, there are consequences, or so my parents taught me years ago.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. As Americans clutch their brackets and watch the NCAA basketball tournaments unfold, one player has gotten lots of attention for pointing out a major disparity.
I got something to show y'all. So for the NCAA March Madness, the biggest tournament in college basketball for women, this is our weight room. Let me show y'all the men's weight room. Now, when pictures of our weight room got released versus the men's, the NCAA came out with a statement saying that it wasn't money, it was space that was a problem. Let me show y'all something else. Here's our practice court, right? And then here's that weight room. And then here's all this extra space.
That's Sedona Prince, a player for the Oregon Ducks, whose TikTok video showing the lack of equipment at the women's facility in San Antonio went viral last week. Women NCAA players said they were also met with inferior weight rooms, meals, and swag bags compared to their male counterparts. On Monday, the Wall Street Journal reported that the NCAA doesn't even allow the women's team to use the iconic trademark slogan, March Madness, in their tournament promotions.
If you aren't upset about this problem, then you're a part of it.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Amira, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Yeah, glad to be back here.
So, wow, the NC, well, should I not say wow? I mean, was this a surprise to the rest of us, or for those of you who know and study the NCAA sports world closely, were you surprised by the disparities in equipment?
Yeah, no, not surprised. I think this is part of a long history of disparity, especially adjudicated by the NCAA. Many statements like former coach Muffet McGraw, Don Staley, a lot of coaches are alluding to this being a long, multi-year problem. I think what I was surprised by was the way that both Ali Kirshner's image of the disparities in the weight rooms and Sedona's TikTok went viral, and the effect that it had in allowing people to speak up, allowing more players to come out, allowing WNBA players to also continue to uplift and highlight those voices, and all coming together to not let the NCAA off the hook. Because you saw at first, right, Sedona's video was in response to the NCAA saying, oh, we know you're seeing the pictures, but there just wasn't enough space. And what we've seen is that these players, this generation, is not content on these excuses kind of being peddled out, and they have taken to TikTok and to Twitter and to Instagram to dispute that and to raise their voice and say, we're not going to take this anymore.
So did the NCAA, I mean, this was a bad thing for the optics of the NCAA. Did anyone rush in to ameliorate the problem right away?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you saw Lynn Holtzman come out. You saw folks, officials say, listen, we didn't have enough space. The food issue wasn't ours. That was a hotel. You know, here, like a number of excuses. I think that the force of an evidence that was presented made those excuses kind of dry up. It's very hard to say you don't have space if there's a beautifully shot TikTok video showing that. And then the tune changed a little bit. Then there were videos, you know, put out by, you know, Mark Emmerich and Lynn Holtzman and these officials from Gavin from the NCAA saying, we apologize, we dropped the ball. We were so focused on having a safe tournament that, you know, here are the ways the logistics got messed up. There should have been more communication. And so they've put out videos apologizing now. But I think that a lot of what, to your point, that they're apologizing for is the optics of it. And there's actually a lot of other issues that didn't necessarily go viral that still point to this gender disparity that are of a lot of concern.
I want to talk about that because often we talk on this show about NCAA issues, and they're often through the lens of male athletes. And so this part of what's interesting to me here is to really examine. We know that a lot of male athletes aren't treated very well, and there are lots of complications with how they can market themselves and what they're paid and sort of how they're, you know, in many ways, in some instances, used by universities. And really, you know, it's a very complicated thing to be a high level sports or athlete, I should say, at that level. But for women's teams, what are some of the discrepancies that we're not hearing about? Are they paid the same? What else is behind the scenes here when it comes to women NCAA?
Yeah, and I would point out two things. So first of all, some of the things that we aren't hearing perhaps as much about that we should pay attention to is the COVID testing that is being brought in for the women is not the same PCR testing that is provided in Indianapolis, despite, as Dan Solomon from the Texas Monthly has reported, San Antonio having a site specifically for PCR testing. So inferior COVID tests that aren't as quick, aren't as effective is a problem. The way the NCAA counted children and nursing infants against the team's account for how many people you could bring into the bubble really disadvantages parenting coaches, particularly women, especially if they are nursing and need to make a choice between bringing another member of personnel or their baby that they're providing sustenance to. And so these are like kind of other things that are systemic that are occurring that are of much concern. And you pointed at the top of the show, the issue of branding and March Madness, of course. But the other thing I really want to say is that the conversations that we have about exploitation on the men's side are not separate from this issue, right? So one of the things that we saw in response to some of these viral videos and images, people say, oh, it's about revenue, it's about revenue. Well, by that logic, you're accepting a really nice steak and a good weight room as compensation for a tournament that's generating billions of dollars on the back of this unpaid labor. And when we talk about name, image, and likeness, there's a way that sometimes we talk about women and we talk about Title IX, like, women athletes don't stand to benefit from name, image, and likeness as well. And we know.
But Amira, isn't Title IX compliance supposed to make sure these things don't happen?
But it doesn't apply to the NCAA, right? Mm-hmm. And so there was a lawsuit back in 99, NCAA versus Smith. And one of the things that lawsuit did is provide cover to the NCAA, where even though they take a lot of money from federally funded institutions, they are not a federally funded institution and they are not under the purview of Title IX. And so Title IX still, you know, creates this thing that you have to reach, this compliance you have to reach at the school level. But when you transfer to a postseason tournament, it doesn't have the same reach, which is one of the issues that you're seeing here, is that a lot of what they do is, you know, quote unquote, in good faith, but they don't have that same mandate as the schools would to provide equity on the basis of the law.
We've got about a minute left, but I'm wondering, is there one thing that the NCAA could do today to remedy some of these issues with their women's teams?
Yeah, I mean, I think stop making excuses, invest, understand that we need a new path forward. The ratings have been growing, viewership, all of this has been growing. And so the fact that at the end of the day, there's no revenue sharing, even with the ESPN package, that the winner of the women's tournament will not walk away with a cent from this growing behemoth of opportunity and tournament that we have here is just another example of how this system is quite exploitative. And they just need to do better. They need to put their money where their mouth is, stop painting equality on your courts, right, and stand up and actually provide a good experience for these women who have worked so hard to be here.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State and co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Amira, always great to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Earlier this month, the California State Legislature introduced a bill that would bar employers from testing their employees for past marijuana use. For legalization advocates, this may seem like a no-brainer, especially for a state in which medical and recreational marijuana is legal. But throughout the country, even in California, testing prospective employees for marijuana use in states where it's legal is a little more complicated than you might think. Despite 15 states having legal recreational marijuana laws and 36 states with legal medical marijuana at the federal level, businesses are still deciding whether to test prospective employees for the substance. The issue has even made its way to the White House, where just last week the Biden administration fired at least five employees for past marijuana use. This despite the fact that recreational marijuana use is legal in Washington, D.C. Joining me now is Mona Jung, cannabis policy reporter with Politico. Mona, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me, Tanzina.
So let's talk about what the California bill is intended to do.
Yeah, the California bill would essentially bar employers from conducting pre-employment drug tests on prospective hires. However, it does contain some exemptions, such as, you know, safety-sensitive positions, truck drivers, pilots, you know, construction workers, anyone who uses heavy machinery. A lot of these types of laws contain exemptions to those types of industries.
Has it gotten any pushback yet? Or does it seem to, you know, make sense for folks to say, okay, well, for most jobs, I don't need to be tested, but for these jobs that require a certain amount of coordination, I should be tested?
Yeah, you know, it does make sense. And there's not a lot of pushback to these types of policies in more liberal states. More than a dozen states that have medical marijuana laws on the books also have some sort of anti-discrimination laws for medical marijuana patients. Similar bills have been introduced in the past in California. I don't think it's for lack of political will or anything like that. I think these types of proposals are broadly supported. It's just a matter of, you know, whether the legislature can get to them before the end of session.
Do we know of other states that have attempted to pass legislation like this?
Yeah. So, you know, states approach this issue differently. There are laws that ban pre-employment screening, pre-employment drug tests for marijuana use. There are also laws that basically say employers are not allowed to discriminate against medical marijuana patients. And two states, Maine and Vermont, have similar anti-discrimination language for recreational marijuana use. But it is a complicated issue for states because they do have to exempt, you know, safety sensitive industries and also any industries that have to adhere to any sort of federal safety guidelines that require them to test for marijuana use, you know, things like pilots and that type of job. Those positions have to be exempted in the laws. And and the way the courts have handled it has been kind of a patchwork.
Tell us a little bit about that. Why has it been a patchwork?
The laws differ from state to state, and I think it really probably just comes down to the court and the judges. The first case in the U.S. to really litigate this was a case in Colorado where a medical marijuana patient sued his employer, the Dish Network, for firing him for his lawful state legal medical marijuana use. You know, he had a stellar employee record, always had great reviews, and he used medical marijuana not on the job, so he wasn't impaired on the job. That case went all the way up to the Colorado Supreme Court, who ruled against him. They ruled in favor of the employer and said that because marijuana is still illegal under federal law, his employer was allowed to do this, essentially. Since then, I think state courts have started ruling more in favor of patients in these cases, especially in states where there is that sort of anti-discrimination language in the law. You know, you've seen cases in Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Rhode Island, where people have failed pre-employment drug screenings or maybe had a drug test on the job and failed that. and have won in court. You know, the courts have said you cannot discriminate against someone for being a legal medical marijuana patient in the state.
Mona, at the federal level, marijuana is still an illegal substance. And we saw what happened at the White House recently, where the Biden administration asked certain employees to disclose their past marijuana use, and some of those employees were fired. Is that because of the fact that marijuana at the federal level is illegal, despite the fact that Washington, D.C. has recreational marijuana use laws on the books?
Yes, I think federal illegality definitely is a huge reason why this sort of thing continues to happen. And different federal agencies approach the issue differently. The FBI, for example, I believe, you can't have marijuana use in the past year. The NSA, it's like 3 years or something like that. Generally speaking, federal agencies, including the military, are sort of loosening their restrictions on past marijuana use just because of so many states legalizing the substance and, you know, having trouble recruiting qualified candidates. And I think you see that phenomenon in employers in states as well that have legalized, where even in states that don't have any sort of anti-discrimination laws on the books, employers are increasingly not testing employees for marijuana just because more people are using marijuana and they don't want to limit their applicant pool.
I'm wondering also, I know that there are companies that test for a wide range of substances. So you can, in the past, before many of these laws took place, you could be tested for marijuana, cocaine, other drugs. And I'm wondering if those drug tests are still happening and they're just excluding marijuana testing from the spectrum of tests that they're offering to prospective employees.
Yes, yes, that's absolutely still happening. You know, a lot of people still test for marijuana, though. I think in states where they aren't sort of firing employees for marijuana tests or refusing to hire them for marijuana tests, even if a marijuana test comes back positive, they may not use that as a justification for firing them. But the other types of drug tests are still happening, and positive marijuana drug tests are actually on the rise because more people are consuming it in states where it's legal.
Well, let's talk about that, because there are folks, they have prescriptions for medical marijuana, and then there are folks who use it recreationally. Does the law look at that differently? And I guess the other question is, does the law look at marijuana use while being employed as different than marijuana use that you may have done prior to being employed?
Yeah, I think, first of all, there are a lot more sort of anti-discrimination protections in state laws for medical marijuana users versus recreational marijuana users. And a lot of these laws, they contain language that basically says this law doesn't prohibit employers from maintaining drug-free workplace policies. And a lot of those laws are explicit in that it just because there are these anti-discrimination laws, it doesn't mean that people can show up to work impaired, right? The difficulty with these laws and for employers is that there isn't a test that can test for marijuana impairment like you have with an alcohol breathalyzer, for example. So, you know, it's hard to prove in court that an employee is impaired. You can smoke a joint 2 weeks ago and test positive for marijuana today. So the technology is lagging on this, and there isn't a clear impairment test. And employers are still allowed to say, hey, you can't show up to work impaired. But how that gets sorted out in the courts without that sort of impairment test, it's fuzzy.
Mona, how is this affecting drug tests across the board? I mean, there are, you know, everything you just said, you could smoke a joint 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago even, and you could still test positive, whereas other drugs might leave your system more quickly, and you could still use them and maybe go undetected. So it's always felt, at least to me, like sort of an uneven testing mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering whether or not the issue of drug testing at all is really coming under scrutiny, right? In terms of whether it's used as a pre-employment tool or whether it's used as an employment tool while people are currently employed. I mean, employers can still say, we do spot drug testing, or we do surprise drug testing, can't they?
Yeah, they can. And also a lot of employers and some of these medical marijuana cases have come out of situations where an employee had an accident at work or something which triggers an automatic drug test. I think the conversation around drug testing is so far really focused on cannabis use because there are so many states liberalizing their marijuana laws. And I think as a result of the liberalization of state marijuana laws, these conversations are slowly starting to also happen for other drugs. You know, you've seen liberal states like Oregon, for example, that very early on allowed medical marijuana and recreational marijuana. And now it's, you know, now the conversation has shifted to just drug decriminalization as a whole. So I think as more states liberalize their marijuana laws, you're going to see the conversation shift as far as drug testing is concerned from like just looking at marijuana to like a broader discussion about drug use in general.
And finally, I'm wondering if you can give us an update on what efforts at the federal level look like to make marijuana legal, because the House voted in favor of decriminalizing marijuana last December. But since then, what do we know?
That's right. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has made it clear that marijuana legalization is a priority of his, which is a sharp departure from his predecessor, Mitch McConnell. I think with the MORE Act passed the House, you know, everybody knew that it didn't have a chance in a Senate led by McConnell. He was never going to bring a bill like that up for a vote. Of course, with Schumer, that has shifted. However, a bill like that is going to need 60 votes to pass in the Senate. And so if every single Democrat votes for the MORE Act, for example, you're still going to need to get 10 Republicans on board. So I think that folks in the sort of marijuana industry can be overly optimistic about the chances for federal legalization. I think the chances for some piecemeal incremental legislation are much higher. Things like the Safe Banking Act, which would allow state legal cannabis businesses to access banks and financial services, you know, that has strong bipartisan support. So stuff like that definitely has a higher chance of passing.
Mona Jung is a cannabis policy reporter with Politico. Mona, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's all we have for you today, folks. We really hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll be back with you again tomorrow. If you miss us live, don't forget, you can check out our podcast. And just a note that we've been following the news out of Colorado this week, where 10 people were killed by a gunman in a supermarket in Boulder. Our thoughts are with the victims and families right now. If you have suggestions or comments about the show, 877-869-8253 is our number, or click on Contact Us at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.